I'm Jason Klom, and this is Comedy on Vinyl. The year is 1961. The album An Evening with Mike Nichols and Elaine May. They are not my guests this week. The artists, Mike Nichols and Elaine May. My guest this week is Mimi Pond. Thank you so much for doing the show.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
If people don't know who you are, they should know who you are. But I was not expecting you to pick of all the, knowing your work at all, I didn't expect you to pick Nichols and May. But I feel like they really kind of span this interesting demographic on the show. All kinds of different people have picked Nichols and May and their various albums to talk about. I want to know when you first heard it or first heard of Nichols and May at all.
Gosh, I think I was still a teenager, or maybe I was in my early 20s. And I wasn't used to seeing women in comedy be smart and funny. I mean, there's sort of daffy and funny like Goldie Hawn, and there's, you know, wacky and ugly like Phyllis Diller, and there's self-deprecating like Joan Rivers, but there was no one like Elaine May for just being really clever and smart. Yeah. And she was really inspiring. I mean, there was just no one else out there doing that.
Yeah. And I mean, she's another person who, if you're interested in comedy, you really need to know about Elaine May. Sorry to take my microphone. Now, she's a person who I'll never have on this show because she hasn't done an interview in 40 years. But she's another person I'm just absolutely obsessed with, whose career started in improv, but she has also written or script doctored about a billion things that people have seen if they're not aware. And yeah, I mean, she, you're absolutely right. I mean, she had an energy and a different way and a different approach to any other women comedians at the time.
Yeah, and she and Mike Nichols just blended together so perfectly. Mm-hmm. And here's another thing about Mike Nichols I want to say right up front. So Mike Nichols had alopecia. He was completely bald. Nobody knew it. He wore a wig. Even eyebrows, I think he had to put on. And he wore a wig for years. Now, nobody knew he was bald. That was such a convincing wig. Now, why couldn't anyone else have a wig like that? Like Burt Reynolds, who, you know, wore that squirrel on his head all those years. You know, and, you know, I mean, the list goes on and on, including, you know, our current turd in chief. Like, nobody seems to have mastered the wig like Mike Nichols mastered the wig. It's just astonishing.
I had no idea. I'm now looking, because here's the thing. The second you said that, I'm like, he does have perfect eyebrows. And I'm now looking at the album on the wall, and I'm like, oh my God, is nothing that had never occurred to me. That
nobody knew.
Remarkable. So youthful appearing, and it makes sense. That is a very good wig. That's a very good wig. Also, I mean, come on, this album cover in general, I mean, they both look delightful. Her energy on this cover is remarkable. She's just got this huge smile. And I think I've talked about this before, but the two of them, like, picking to play, not just, like, they'll play any dynamic that works for a male-female dynamic, including mother and son, including lovers. Do you have a rough idea? Was this an album you bought, or was it in your house growing up?
Oh, no, where did I find it? In a thrift store, or maybe in a record store? It wasn't in our house. We had other albums. Of course, like every other house in America, there was the Vaughn Meter JFK album. Mm-hmm. And there was also, as required by federal law, there was every Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass album ever made.
Of course. Of course, including whipped cream and other delights. If they didn't have it, that was your find, right?
I know someone who tiled her ceiling with those album covers.
Holy shit. Wow. Oh, my God. That woman was interviewed a few years ago, the model for the cover of that album. I'm trying to remember what she does now. But either way, like, that's still her claim to fame, is being that weird lady covered in whipped cream on the cover of it.
That every sub-teen boy just stared at. Endlessly.
And I'm the weirdo who, speaking of which, I own 20 copies of The First Family. That is no lie. I, for some reason, am obsessed with buying that.
They were easy to find.
Oh, very easy. I think that's why. I think that's part of it. So were you, what was your knowledge of improv when you picked this album up?
Nothing. I mean, really nothing. The other comedy album we had Alan Sherman.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, Alan Sherman and Mad Magazine was the only reason I knew that summer camp existed. Because for me, summer camp was summer school.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, Southern California, like, it's already like camp.
Fair, yeah.
You know, and we didn't have the money to be sent to camp. And you know, my mother wanted us out of her hair, and they offered these, like, enrichment summer school classes. So she just signed me right up for, like, 9 years in a row. Oh,
my God. Holy cow.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff were you learning? Was there any artistic stuff, or is this just...
Sort of artistic. There was a Greek mythology class that was really fun. That's how I learned to type.
Wow.
When it was still fun, mm-hmm. when you're like, you know, 9 and 10 years old, it's typing is fun as opposed to later.
Yeah, yeah.
There was some, you know, math classes, probability, things like, you know, we were like spending our mornings tossing dice.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Oh my gosh. That's weird to me. The idea of that as your extracurricular is just more school, basically, is weird. I mean, did you do anything crafty, anything like that, that you would typically associate?
No.
Okay.
I I was always the artistic kid, so I would have been, you know, all ready for that. But it was mostly, you know, I remember, like, the mythology class, we'd, we put on plays and stuff. And I remember the teachers, this woman with red hair, and she's like, Minerva, how I love the name Minerva. It's funny, the stuff that sticks with you.
Holy crap. That's so good. I love it. I mean, you know, I was the kid who I needed study hall so that I could just draw nonstop. That's basically the only reason I was ever, you know, put up with school. If I'd had, my goodness. So you're a young lady and you discover this album. You don't know anything about improv. Is the first thing that strikes you just that it's just really, really hilarious? Because it still holds up to me.
It was brilliant. And as I said, there were so few women doing, you know, that in my radar doing smart comedy. And it was like smart and funny and female. And it was like that she was taken seriously at all. It was kind of a miracle. Yeah. In fact, her whole career was kind of a miracle. She like started out as an unwed mother. Her parents just said, we'll take the baby. You go have a career, which is like,
wow.
Who did that then in the mid 50s?
That's right.
Who did that?
I didn't know that. Holy cow.
I wish I knew more about her life and how that happened. But she was allowed to you know, go off to New York and have a career.
Wow. And be the funniest person. No, not to shit on Mike Nichols. I think he's brilliant. They're a great team, but she's the funniest person on these records. She's just blows me away every time.
Oh,
just,
yeah. Her nuances are brilliant.
So good. I mean, I it's so crazy because, and again, we've talked about this before, but this is only a 4-track album. There's 4 tracks on this whole thing.
Yeah.
And it is and I have gone over it and over it and over it and tried to pick a favorite a million times. But I mean, even just to start at the first one, I mean, she starts out doing, I guess, you know, this sort of typical, what we're used to is a, you know, an old operator, although those don't really exist anymore, but I'm used to the stereotype of that kind of operator. And just, I mean, she plays 3 different characters, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they all sound roughly similar, but.
Except for the last one, who's like, you know, breathless and, you know, enchanting.
Oh, sir. She's just so good. And it's all about, I mean, and to make a whole sketch that is, I think, you know, at its heart about the male ego, but once you get down to it, she's just got to, like, make this dumb piece of crap feel better about himself, which is insane to me. I love it so much. So after listening to this record, I mean, and was it inspiring, too? Did you hunt down more of their stuff or more stuff?
Yeah, I did. In fact, I thought there were some other routines that are on some other record that I really love. There's a dentist sketch he's going to Saudi Arabia to do dental work or something.
Mm-hmm. They're so good. And I think they only, I could be wrong on this. They only did three records, I think, something like that. And they're just, they're.
And he went off to have this monster career. Yes. And she just went to Hollywood and got shit on all over the place. Mm-hmm. And I think her most brilliant work is A New Leaf with Walter Matthau. Mm-hmm. And she disowned it. She wanted her name taken off. They took it away from her because she got obsessed trying to edit it. And then, of course, she became the excuse Hollywood had for not hiring women directors for another, 15 years, 20 years after that. Oh, no, because we tried it with this one chick and she couldn't handle it. So, you know, women, they just can't do it.
And yet you ask Stanley Kubrick to make a movie and he'll take a month to get a shot right. And somehow that's okay.
Yeah, sure. That's fine.
Oh, God. When I hear shit like that, I'm just like, I don't, you know, I want to quit the film business, make some room. And B, I don't understand this. This is the kind of stuff that drives me out. I mean, it's still happening. Don't get me wrong. I mean,
it drives you crazy.
Yeah, of course. Of course. I do want to know if there's anything that is off the table to talk about in your career, because you have a fascinating career. But I mean, and you tell me if you don't want to talk about anything, but I will say at the very least, I would like to thank you for setting the tone for a show that has kind of blown comedy out of the water. You set the tone for The Simpsons, and that's huge.
I can't take credit for that because it just happened to be the first episode they had ready to run.
Uh-huh.
So it was just like, you know, Matt was our friend from comics. Mm-hmm. And he was asking all his other cartoonist friends if they wanted to write an episode, and I guess I was the only one who said yes. And then it was like, well, what do you want to write about? You want to write a Christmas episode? I said, sure, I hate Christmas, so you know. But I'm really kind of tired of talking about it because thrown off the moving gravy train because Sam Simon didn't want any women mm-hmm. on the staff because he was going through a divorce. This is what I learned like 15 years later. I spent all this time wondering, like, what did I do wrong? Why didn't I get picked? I must not have been good enough. No, I just didn't have a dick, you know. And did anyone bother to call me and tell me, you know, sorry, this isn't going to happen because you don't have a dick? No, of course not.
Mm-mm. No, yeah. I mean, it's actionable once they admit what's actually going on. Yeah, that's fair. And I wasn't sure if you wanted
now, to. It was business as usual.
Yeah.
I mean, there were lots of other shows. There were shows, you know, I had an agent and I'd say like, well, what about this show? Oh, they already have a woman. And that was like, you, what?
That's not how that goes. I mean, not how that's supposed to go.
And you know, if you objected back then at all, I am here to tell you like, oh, you just don't have a sense of humor.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I remember when I first moved out here, I had a very close friend who was convinced that he had logicked out. Like, he's like, I just don't think women are as funny as men. And I'm like, okay, can you walk me through why the fuck you think this? And he was, it's the same. It is this, obviously, clearly, a pattern among people who I haven't seen enough of them be funny. So.
Including people like Tony Hendra, who's like said that right up front.
And then the bigger the name, like a Jerry Lewis, the bigger the name that says shit like that, the more people just latch onto it like it must be the facts. Like that must be true, you know. And there's no funny women. Lucille Ball wasn't funny is what I believe he said, Jerry Lewis. I mean, among several other terrible
things. Well, you know, it's interesting because Bob Hope was Phyllis Diller's mentor. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you go back and watch any of her routines, she's like just Bob Hope made over in a funny wig. but you know, she's a hero of mine too, because she was out there doing that with five kids. Her husband was a total deadbeat. Mm-hmm. She was writing ad copy, and you know, her husband said, "You're funny," and she had some friend who was part of the, you know, the very nascent improv scene in San Francisco. She was living in Alameda with her husband and her five kids, and he had been in the Navy, but then he was out of the Navy, and he were like, just, you know, she was it, you know, she was like writing ad copy, radio copy, you know, just whatever she could. And she started putting together an act, and eventually, you know, was playing in places like The Hungry Eye and The Purple Onion. And she and her husband made this decision that they were going to take 5 years and try to make it. And she had to park her children with the grandparents in Ohio. And she said, I interviewed her shortly before she died.
Wow.
And she said that that was the hardest thing she ever had to do.
I bet.
And, you know, just that's like, that's a major sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And then she played the Fountain Blue in Miami, and Bob Hope saw it. And even though she bombed, he knew she had something, and he kind of took her under his wing and, you know, helped promote her, which really put her on the map. And that's when, you know, she hit it.
That's crazy. Wow. First of all, what the hell was it like interviewing Phyllis Diller? Holy shit.
Well, she was amazing. She had been having these open houses to sell her artwork. She'd like retired from stand up, but she was making art, and she was making so much art all her friends wanted it. So she just decided to open her house like once every few months, and people could come in and buy stuff off the walls.
Wow.
So if you knew someone who knew someone who knew her assistant, you could get in. So
yeah.
I got the email and, you know, asked to come to one of them. And then I thought, well, this would make a great cartoon for the LA Times. Mm-hmm. And I just kept bugging this assistant until she let me come. She said, well, you can have half an hour with her. And I wound up being there for like, you know, over an hour. And, yes. And while she was painting in her little studio, and she was, you know, she was very sweet and kind. And, you know, I said, you know, like, did you feel like you were in a really hostile environment with male comedians when you were starting out? And she said no. And I was like, you've got to be kidding.
Yeah.
Because everyone was, you know, male comedians are so mean. This is something that makes me insane about the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Because it doesn't honor the kind of sacrifice and stress and misery that female comedians went through. Mm-mm. When they were trying to come into comedy in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
You know, it was brutal. It's still brutal. It's not as brutal, but it's, sure. You know, it's people like Louis C.K. Yes, it's still brutal.
Sure, sure.
So I would, you know, I think she said the only person that was ever mean to her was Mort Saul.
Really?
Yeah, I think. And maybe Louis Nye.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Which is unfortunate because I love Louis Nye.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting because I interviewed, I don't know if you've ever heard Rusty Warren.
Yeah.
But she's a friend of mine, and I interviewed her a few years ago. And, like, it's quite the converse. She was quite clear about the crazy shit that happened to her. But at the same time, she's also had to move that to a different part of her brain where it's just like, oh, no, that's just how it was. It's like, oh, no.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, it was how it was, of course, and you have to survive. But the idea that somebody either at least attempting to assault you is just like, oh, no, that's how it was. It's like, oh, fuck. Yeah, right. That's what it was when it registered with me for the first time as a younger man. I'm like, oh, uh-huh. Yeah, I don't understand this at all. I was just like,
the shit I put up with as a young woman is like, mm-hmm. It was just how it was. You know, you just were expected at some point that was going to happen. You know, that was just the expectation.
Right.
You know, there's all these parts of your brains that are like, how do I get out of this? Mm-hmm. All the time. All the time.
And then the maybe not the expectation, but the hope I would imagine is, oh, I have worked my way up in an industry I care about. I've earned the right to not be treated that way also in my career. But then is it a surprise when it is also part of the the artistic career or entertainment career? Does it become a surprise, or were you prepared, do you think, for how shitty you were going to be treated?
I've been prepared all my life because it's been happening to me all my life. And I had two brothers growing up who with their asshole teenage friends. So I was fully prepared for that.
Yeah. My goodness.
That was business as usual.
Sure. Sure. So
you're just a girl. Girls aren't funny.
And it never changes. I mean, like, that's it does come from the exact same place too. It comes from that just animal lizard brain bullshit.
Yeah.
And then men are enabled to act how they want for the rest of their lives. I know.
Yeah.
It happens to me still, and I just turned 40. It just like it's super fun. We live in super fun times and a super fun culture. So I cannot stop looking at all the stuff around your office. Delightfully sparse office, but there's so much art around the room that is like, it's hard. I'm like trying to make it out. My goodness. If we talk about Elaine May. And Elaine May, we can talk about Mike Nichols too, but obviously I'm fascinated with Elaine May as well. Does she still, sir, if you listen to this, does it still like sort of flash you back a little bit to like, oh, right, this is what got me interested in, yeah. I mean, did it get you interested in comedy in general?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
The idea, you know, like, yes, women can do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you were told constantly all the things you couldn't do. Like there were no female directors. So that was out. That was just like, you know, no, it just, mm-hmm. you know, might as well have said you needed two heads to be a director. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like that was not an option. I was told I could be a cartoonist because my father was an amateur cartoonist and he was like, he loved comics and introduced me to Mad Magazine, you know, the Signet paperbacks of the EC stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I put them in my chubby little hands when I was 6 years old and I was like, you know, just riveted.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and everyone's like, oh, she's going to be a cartoonist when she grows up. It's like, okay, I guess, yeah, that's it. Okay. So that was, you know, the gift I was given, luckily. Mm-hmm. And there were so many other things you were told you couldn't do. And it's like, I don't remember who it was. It was a teacher. It's like, well, can I do this? Like, no, that's a man's job, but you could help a man. You could be a helper. And I was like, what? No! Not a helper.
A helper. What the shit? You, which is code for you can do a ton of the work, but you got to give him credit. Like, that's what the code is. Like, when did you first, like, get a taste of creating your own thing that was all your own thing?
That's a good question. I mean, I was drawing and making comics here and there. I think actually when I was in art school, I was very fortunate in my first semester. I took a class called Printmaking and Creative Writing, and it was letterpress printing mm-hmm. with writing. So you got to write and then print your own books.
And
you know, you could illustrate them with, you know, any various methods of printmaking. You could do, you know, linoleum cuts, or you could do, you could make a drawing and have a line engraving made. It was then, it was like photo engraved and then put on a Taipei block. So you could like have your drawings and your writing combined. And that was like,
good.
I'd grown up in a family of book lovers. So the idea of making my own books, that was like, you know, that was the whole package. So yeah. That was exciting.
Oh, that's so
good. Then I took a class like two more times and the teacher and I wound up collaborating on an artist book, that I wrote and illustrated and she was responsible for making sure that it looked really beautiful and it didn't have goobers all over it, which my method.
Please tell me you have these. Do you still have copies of these sitting around? Oh, that's so good. I'm so glad to hear that. I always get afraid because sometimes I'll talk to you like, oh, I don't know what I did with that. And I just get so disappointed.
Hang on.
Oh, yes. Please, please, please.
The dusty. It's got a shower cap for a cover.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
And then a clear vinyl cover. And then you open it up and it's got nylon net here.
Holy
and then
shit.
You open it up.
This and it's got. It looks so beautiful too. You don't expect anything. Oh my God. This is so good. Holy shit. That's remarkable.
So yeah, those were very satisfying to do.
Of course. Holy. I mean, it's not just ownership too. It's proof that you did a thing and it's hard to find that. Especially when you're young, but my good God, I've never made anything in my whole life that looks this nice. It's so good.
And my partner, Betsy Davids, she's kind of a pioneering force in the letterpress world. Which is, you know, letterpress has gotten hip lately, but mm-hmm. we were doing it back in the 70s. Oh, this is funny.
It's so good. It's so good. Who were your like deepest in terms of like cartooning inspirations, and then in terms of writing?
Oh, cartooning inspirations. Well, of course, Mad Magazine,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of New Yorker comics, and you know, like George Price and George Booth, of course, is brilliant, and a lot of stuff. The Lampoon, Mary Kay Brown from the Lampoon, and Sherry Flanagan, who became a great mentor of mine and a hero. She was the first. She was the cartoon editor at the National Lampoon. She was the reason I got in the Lampoon. She was trying to get in as many women as she could at the time, which was great.
Mm-hmm.
But it had to have been really, I haven't spoken to her in many years, but it must have been just such a toxic environment for her at the Lampoon.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's so funny is I had on the writers of that rough biopic movie, The National Lampoon. And
oh, it was so awful.
That is not really addressed at all. The woman thing is just like, it's like, it's a toss. It's just, it's a, the woman thing. And I feel like it's, I don't recall it being addressed at all.
Yeah. I got in big trouble because they were going to do this 2-page spread. It was a parody of a Maidenform bra commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something like, you know, I dreamed I was in an airplane crash in my Maidenform bra. And there's all these dead women, you know, in underwear, you know, spread all over this airplane wreckage. And I made the mistake of saying, you know, you think dead women are funny? They didn't like that.
Oh, my God. They didn't. Well, I mean, typically, they don't have a sense of humor. Some of the biggest comedians or comedy people don't have a sense of humor. Boy, oh boy. Wow. That's something. That is something.
They did not like that at all.
Of course not. Of course they didn't. Boy. This is just like, you know, and I mean, Sorry, like this is what I could talk about this all day because this is, again, not my life experience, will never be my life experience. But you also please feel free to tell me when you're bored talking about it. But it is something that, I mean, I've noticed on my own show. I don't interview enough women. I don't interview enough people of color. So, you know, all my lists lately have been like, OK, I'm going to stop, you know, at least specifically asking white men to be on the show because it's all they're doing is reflecting back to me what I think I understand about comedy. And I know that I'm missing so much. Even Elaine May, though, like she has helped form my idea and my understanding of comedy, but I, as a young person, didn't attribute it to anything other than, oh, she's just real funny. But I mean, that is there's an extra perspective there that I couldn't count for, wasn't paying attention to, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and it doesn't come down to anything other than she's just a different type of person than I am. And this is one of those things that doesn't get appreciated. All right. So the first thing is, so that does, I mean, that's a very visceral thing to have in your hand, a book. How about beyond that? Something after having something you can physically hold in your hand, because then I know that it gets a little bit more ethereal. It doesn't really, you know, I've made movies, I've made TV, I make a podcast. It doesn't really, it's not something you can feel or touch anymore. So it's harder to feel like you own it or you did anything with it. But you've written plenty, you've made so much stuff. Is there anything after that that's then also you were able to feel like you owned it?
Yeah, I mean, I was fortunate enough to become friends with Tom Waits, who is a big hero of mine when I was in art school. And I was able to connect with him and become friends. And he was a great mentor to me. It meant the world to me that he validated what I was doing. And he asked me to illustrate a songbook of his. So I did all these etchings for this songbook, and it never did get published. I had this horrible manager, Herbie Cohen, who was robbing him blind, as it turned out, and he was a real creep. But I got paid. Tom paid me.
Mm-hmm.
But it never saw the light of day. But still, it was like, you know, it was this full package. It was this thing I could be proud of. And then I was in art school for 3 years. I ran out of money. I had quit. And I mean, I was kind of done with art school anyway. I already had like a year and a half prior to going to art school of dicking around at community college. So mm-hmm. I had a good like 4.5 years of school under my belt already. So I was ready to move on, and I was kind of tired of the ivory tower environment of art school.
Okay.
And I was fortunate enough to get this job in this restaurant, which is the only restaurant on earth I probably could have ever worked in because it was so crazy. And which later became the subject of my 2 graphic novels, Over Easy and The Customer mm-hmm. is Always Wrong. And the manager there was a former Latin scholar and a poet who was encouraging all these, you know, ex-art students who drifted in to do their work besides working in this restaurant. And the whole restaurant gig was just kind of like this goof. It was like a side gig we all had to make money. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, the really important thing was our own work. And that was the atmosphere that I was working in. And he became a very dear friend. And, you know, you got backed up when customers gave you attitude. And you could get away with just about anything as long as you did your job well. It didn't mean that you gave bad service. It was just that you were allowed to have an extra, you know, additional helping of attitude. And it was just a really unique atmosphere in which to work. And I was, you know, doing these like comics pretty much just for like people's birthday cards and stuff, and people kept saying you should be published somewhere, and someone told me I should go see this editor at the Berkeley Barb. So I did, and he said, well, you know, we've already got Zippy the Pinhead, but we got this other newspaper, The Spectator, they probably can use some stuff. And you know, he pointed across the room at this other guy at a desk, and The Spectator was the newspaper that was really keeping the Berkeley Barb afloat at that point. It was a adult classifieds newspaper.
Uh-huh.
That's all it was. And so for $12 a week, I got to have a cartoon in The Spectator, which meant that I started amassing clippings that I could send off to magazines in New York, which is
right.
How I was sent stuff off to the Lampoon, and Sherry Flanagan responded and wanted to buy some. So that was my big break.
Wow. How do you feel? This is going to tell a lot about me, but how do you know that you can do it? Knowing that you can, having the confidence that you can write and draw a cartoon that is going to work for people. What is it a gut thing, or is there a logical part to it? Cause it just, I love
well,
cartoons
I mean,
so
I'd,
much,
I'd,
but
I'd already had a lot of encouragement from, mm-hmm. you know, people who I really respected. Mm-hmm. So I had that help tremendously.
Sure.
And it was just, you know, I, you know, there was enough of me that knew I was funny, mm-hmm. you know, and I was just as funny as some of the stuff I was seeing published. So that helped. And then Sherry Flanagan was kind of basically taught me how to make a comic strip with like a, you know, a setup and a punchline and some other, you know, a couple other things in between. So mm-hmm. I have her to thank for that as well.
Wow. That's amazing. I also love that you can be a published, you know, cartoonist and then just like still also have another step to go, but also still be so good at what you do. I love that you can track your own evolution in print probably then in a way that maybe other people can't. So were you doing just single panel stuff early on, or was
it? When there were single panels, they were like, I draw a character and then I just kind of improvised what the character was saying. And I wrote it alongside of the drawing, like a monologue.
God. Okay.
And then Sherry was the one that taught me how to like break it up into a story.
Okay.
Because I, you know, for some whatever reason, I really wasn't doing that very much. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I get it. Off to the races.
That's amazing. I mean, that's not unlike, honestly, how this album was created, because apparently they worked it all out in improv, and rarely anybody knows. If you see improv, it's usually terrible. They've been polished,
you know,
it, you know?
Improv, like 98% of all improv is the opportunity for people to invite their friends to come and improvise being enthusiastic.
Uh-huh.
It's like, it's work for the audience. That's mm-hmm. what I resent it so much. It's like the audience gets to come in after where you're like, ah, and then afterwards you're like, yeah, that was just, Wow. I just thought you were, and that part, oh my gosh, I was laughing. Oh, and then, you know, and then you see some stuff that's really brilliant, like the Groundling. Like, that makes all the difference.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Jennifer Coolidge do this great thing. They at the Groundlings, they had this night where it was like the conceit was a local crappy acting school in, you know, in the Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And they were having their showcase of their student talent. And this young woman and young man are supposed to do a scene from Glass Menagerie, but the young woman has stage fright and is throwing up backstage, and her mother steps in to play her part. And her mother is like this brash, obnoxious, overwhelming monster in a Chanel suit, you know, and she's got this Jersey accent. She's like, "Yeah, this is my Glass Menagerie. How do you like it?" I mean, I'll never forget that. It was, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, when it's brilliant, it's you're never going to forget it.
Of course. I mean, you know, and it, even to go back to Jennifer Coolidge, I mean, Christopher Guest edits his movies down. So, I mean, you know, you get the best stuff and you chop it down, or you learn, although those people are given these rough stories, but you do have to work your way to a punchline from what's already in your head. So it's interesting because, again, some improv like this is, they eventually tweaked it. And I think what we get here is probably the perfected version of what was once improv. And I love the idea that your comics, the idea is it just so free flowing that you're just like, well, this would be I can't, again, there's confidence though. Is it confidence or is it the youthful stupidity to not know that you shouldn't be doing it? Is it like, or is there both?
Part of it's just youthful stupidity, and which is good. It's good to have that. That's what makes people move to New York.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's beautiful. And I say stupidity with all love for every artist who isn't a piece of crap. You know, it's, and there are plenty of them. But, you know, for any artist who's just young and doesn't know any better, you learn so much from doing that. I mean, there are so many great examples of art that's come from
You know that. Who else is just absolutely just brilliant is SCTV when it was on in the 80s. It came on at like, I don't know what time, it came on like 1 a.m. or something.
Oh, wow,
I think it
really?
Came on after Saturday Night Live.
Mm-hmm.
And I had like a 14-inch black and white TV in my rat hole apartment on 14th Street. And I would force myself to stay up and watch it, because of course there was no way to record it back then.
Yeah.
And it was just so brilliant. I mean, and people like Catherine O'Hara talk about how miserable their lives were made even by those guys.
Yeah.
You know, so, and they're doing just brilliant work, and just so much. Edith Prickly and
mm-hmm.
you know, just all of that, just so great.
It's crazy too, because somebody like Catherine O'Hara, who's been through all that shit, she gets recognition, but it's still been slow coming, and she's in her 60s. Like, it's crazy to me how much time it takes for people to accept that she's a fucking legend.
Yeah. She and Eugene Levy are just magic together
I can't figure those two out. I don't know how they're that good together at all. And forever they've been that way, seemingly. Just, you have, again, it's kind of Nichols and May. Like, you have this weird kind of energy together. They've just stuck with it. You know, one of them didn't run off and just direct a bunch of pretentious films. No shitting on Mike Nichols, but, you know, I'm just saying they could have, you know, could have brought her along, at least. She also did plenty of great stuff on her own.
But I can't think of anyone who projected more of an entitled air than Mike Nichols.
Have you ever met either of them?
Oh, no.
Okay, I always like to ask, because every once in a while somebody has been, like, you know, somebody does the "I met my heroes," and it's either, you know, it's always either terrible or wonderful. I recommend
Harvey Kurtzman.
Meeting your hero.
I was friends with Harvey Kurtzman. Harvey Kurtzman was wonderful.
Yeah, that's remarkable. See, I mean, that's it's nice when you run into somebody who's not, again, a piece of crap. It happens a lot in this business, especially if they get successful.
Harvey Kurtzman. So talk about lack of confidence. You know, I would talk to him. He lived up in what's the Dick Van Dyke town? It wasn't New Rochelle. It wasn't New Rochelle, but He lived in a suburb of New York City. I can't remember.
Okay.
And so he wasn't in the city that much. But he would call me every once in a while in New York, and I would say, you are the architect of humor for the late 20th century. You know, mm-hmm. you created all this. Everyone else just latched on to what you were doing. And he's like, oh, Mimi, would you call me every day and tell me that? Because he really was. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because, people like him and Mel Brooks, they were doing the same thing. And I don't think Mel Brooks really, I don't know that he was influenced by Harvey Kurtzman. I think they were just in a parallel zone in terms of being the ages that they were and being in New York and seeing things with that same cynical point of view, especially in the 50s when everything was so locked down and so buttoned up and everything. And it was, you know, if you had a sense of humor at all, that stuff was just begging to be made fun of.
Mm-hmm. And then to do it in a way that has got, I mean, I don't know. We've talked about Mad Magazine in various ways on this show. And I've never been able to really even define what it did for me in terms of comedy. It's just part of my blood in terms of, the stuff. Even though I would never go and write a joke that is Mad Magazine appropriate, it's still just part of you. The influence is just there.
I mean, there's Don Martin and Al Jaffe and... Mm-hmm. Even Dave Berg, who was like sort of super corny.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I still loved it all.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was something about it all being in one place together, and it didn't have this. It never felt like it was talking down to you. That might have been the magic of it, making you feel like you're a real grown up.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing. I mean, I think it's weird because that existed that whole time, and yet there was still always this concept that cartoons were strictly for kids when. I mean, just so much brilliant dark material has been made, not at all.
Another big influence was we had Jules Pfeiffer's 666, and that was a huge influence on me because it didn't follow the traditional comic strip trope of panels, you know, divided up. They were loose, mm-hmm. So they were like the drawings with the captions next to the person talking, but it wasn't necessarily in a word balloon.
Okay.
It was like said that comics could be whatever you wanted it to be. And mm-hmm. it was also very adult and sophisticated. So it wasn't just aimed at kids, and it was about, psychology and neuroses. And so that Jules Pfeiffer was an enormous influence.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. How about I'm now realizing how few female names have come up in the cartooning world.
Jules Pfeiffer too.
Oh, you did? Okay. No, please.
Yeah. I met him at, there's all these comics conventions that have acronyms. It's the one in Bethesda, Maryland. It's Small Press Expo, okay. SPX.
Okay.
We wound up talking about how fucked up the 70s were. Uh-huh. Because nobody, kids these days, they think the 70s was all like groovy and disco and stuff. And it was it was such a weird, dark, moral swamp. It really was. Because like when I was in Berkeley, Oakland and Berkeley in the late 70s, my first semester of art school was when they finally found Patty Hearst.
Wow.
And she'd been on the run, and it was like this big, I'm a big Patty Hearst freak for the mm-hmm. whole story. I'm just, because she's, she's like only about a year older than me. So it's like, I really related in a way. And she had this overbearing boyfriend who wanted to run her life. And I'd had a boyfriend like that in high school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, and then, for years I was like, team Patty and everything. And then I read that book that came out, was it last year? Mm-hmm. The newest one by that important journalist who does all the great stuff. Lawrence.
Oh,
yeah. Scientology book too.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, And you're like, you know, she could, or she really could have walked away at any point. But it's just, it's, I mean, it's, I'm also, I still admire her for controlling her narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, she could have easily collapsed under the weight of that. And she just went on with her life, and she went on to become friends with John Waters and be in John Waters movies.
Right.
Who
right.
doesn't love that? Anyway, but you know, like the SLA had assassinated Marcus Foster, who was the first Black superintendent of Oakland schools. They fucking assassinated him. And even the Black Panthers wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole. Yeah. And yet you had all these white liberals in Berkeley going, yeah, go SLA. And I'm like, this is fucked up.
Yeah.
No.
Woof.
People are out of their minds. And they really were completely out of their minds. And it was the kind of thing that only could have happened in the 70s.
Yeah.
So that's just one example.
I mean, it's a thing where I think a lot of my guests have been roughly of your generation. And every time I talk about the 70s with anybody, it is not the same picture from any one person. And when you talk about it from a comedic standpoint, half the time we're just talking about Nixon. Like, I have a dozen albums that came out about Richard Nixon. But
Richard Nixon was the first person I learned to draw a caricature of.
Really?
Yeah, because my father taught me to hate Richard Nixon by throwing darts at a picture of Nixon. That's how he taught me how to throw darts. It was like the target was Nixon. Because he'd hated Nixon ever since he destroyed Helen Cahagan Douglas's career the 50s. And you know, my dad is still, I mean, even now my dad's like 90, 91, and he's like, you know, well, at least Nixon was smart.
Right, right. Isn't that fucking frightening? That is so frightening.
It's terrifying.
When Trump was elected, I did a little thing talking about all my Nixon albums. Just, it was mostly a hint, you can do this. Please don't forget. This is, you know, a stack this thick of records where people were trying to shit on the current president or upcoming president. Please don't forget that you can do that. And yeah, it is now upsetting how I can look back and be like, hey, not that bad, not terrible. Well, he stole an election, but
here's the big difference. Nixon had a sense of shame.
Yeah. He was willing to finally resign once he knew shit was going to come tumbling down on him. I mean, yes, he threw his VP under the bus, which is one of the funniest things in history. But he also did eventually say, well, I'm sorry. I don't know that he ever said I'm sorry. But he definitely said, I'm going now. It was more of a, I'm gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Boy, oh boy. That's, you pray for
things
like that.
But Nixon was really easy to draw because of that ski jump nose and the...
Yeah.
Forehead and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Jowls. It was like a no-brainer.
All the interpretations too, actually, now that you say that, all the interpretations are only slightly different on these album covers. Those obviously are there always there, varying levels of success on those album covers. I'm just now realizing, I don't know, have you ever drawn an album cover? Have you ever made an album cover?
No, I haven't.
That's remarkable to me.
That used to be the, you know, the ultimate thing for illustrators was album covers, because they were just so, you know, they were 12 inches square. So it was like a beautiful template. For, you know, it's like everyone's dream was to do an album cover.
Yeah, I can
now
imagine.
Now they're like, what? Like,
I don't know. right. Unless you go to, you know, there are a couple, you know, companies that still do vinyl, but half the time... They don't, in my opinion, they don't really do it right. They don't take the time. They wouldn't ask a Mimi Pond to fully illustrate, a double-sized thing and then make it look beautiful. It's usually just like, let's Photoshop this as best we can.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's always the case, but
the thing, you know, album covers were like this thing when you were a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You were like, there was no internet. There was the library. There was the newsstand where you could get magazines, but there was no other place you could get a sense of what was supposed to be a visual sense of what was supposed to be cool. And I would like spend hours staring at every square inch of my favorite album covers and try to figure out like, okay, what is it that makes this so cool? How can I get some of this?
Yeah, of course.
You know, like it was incredible. There was a brilliant magazine that came out when I was 12 or 13 called Rags, and it was a countercultural fashion magazine.
Uh-huh.
that it was doomed to failure because it really wasn't about consumerism, because it was about thrift store shopping.
Awesome.
And it only lasted for like 18 issues or so. And I studied it devoutly and I never missed an issue. And then it just disappeared, you know, about a year and a half later. And so fast forward, I've gone to New York. I have a meeting at the Village Voice to meet with one of their editors, Mary Peacock, who has a page called the V Page. And I'm sitting in her office and I look over and there's these bound editions. There's the logo, Rags. I'm like, I know that magazine. Wow. She said, I was the editor.
Holy shit.
And which became a long enduring loving relationship of me working for her at the Voice, and that's really what kicked off my career. Not so much the Lampoon, which was at, you know, in 1982, 83, 84 was you know, people were still buying it, but my, you know, I was getting letters from like teenage boys and prison convicts. That was the audience, you know, but having a full page in the Village Voice was like taking out a full page ad every week in not every week, but often in, you know, in a major New York weekly newspaper for your own work. And that's right. How I got started. It was like, I was contacted by an editor at Dell Books who I had lunch with. And I was like, you know, just entertaining him with stories about the idiot surfers that I went to high school with. And the next thing I knew, he was asking me if I wanted to do a humor book about Valley Girls. And I said, well, what's that? He said, oh, there's this song. And I was like, oh, you know, so I had to go buy the Frank Zappa album. I didn't even have a record player. I had to go to a friend's house, go listen to it, go, yeah, I can do that.
Holy shit. Wow. That is, I mean, that's...
You can make a living as an illustrator and a cartoonist. Right. Like people pay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, my favorite, you know, my favorite artists, like newer artists, are all usually struggling. They're all usually like, hey, real quick, I don't know if you want to pay me a couple bucks so I can go get myself a coffee or pay for my medical insurance today, but that'd be real cool. And then they just do this beautiful art that blows your fucking mind. And it's like, oh, right. The economy is different now.
Yeah. I mean, we moved to LA in 1990. My son was born in 92 and our son was born in 92 and our daughter was born in 95. And, you know, a couple of years later, I looked up and my career was just gone. Mm. You know, it's just like, it just went over the cliff. Mm. It was just gone.
Wow. Obviously I don't understand the economics of it all, but that is, well, fucked up. I mean, this is the only way to say it. That is insane to me.
It's the same. You know, it's the same with like the music industry too. Mm-hmm. It's the same with like, you know, writers and editors. You know, this whole industry of magazines that doesn't exist anymore. There's so far fewer magazines, and no one wants to pay for online content, mm-hmm. which is like, you know, you just think of it as like ballast being shoveled into the furnace to keep the engine going and. Mm-hmm. You know, no one thinks about what's, you know, that people actually, you know, studied for a long time to develop their craft as a writer or as an editor or mm-hmm. as an artist. And I read so much stuff online now that's so poorly edited or it's not edited at all. And, you know, you just look at it and you go, well, you could take that out, you could take that out. And then instead it just goes on and on and on. And people, it's indulged. I mean, mm-hmm. I see people make, you know, who are successful, I don't want to name any names, but like if this was, you know, 20, if this was back in my day, Lord.
And it's unsustainable too, or at least it feels unsustainable, except poor people have been taken advantage of forever. So
part of it is when you had print editions, you had a limited amount of real estate to work in. So you had, you were, you know, you had to edit things down. You had to, it could only be so long. But it also, I learned so much about editing from people like Mary Peacock and other very good editors I had about how to edit yourself.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's just, almost everything is better when it's reduced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's also true of, we're going to go back to it, but improv. I'm guessing these 9-minute tracks were 20-minute improvs that just got turned into, no, these are the funny bits. Please leave the rest of that shit out where you made yourselves laugh. And then there you go.
That's what art is. It's reduction.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone just thinks it's like, right. No, it's like, that's not that.
It's not free time in class. It's not just that. The discipline is figuring out which of that stuff works.
The aim is to make it look effortless.
Sure. Sure. What are your opinions on, but there's got to be, I feel there has to be an artist out there though, who does get away with some bullshit where you're like, you don't have to name names, but where it's like, you're just throwing shit out there and just making, and then it just feels, there are people who are like, well, Jackson Pollock was full of shit. He was just throwing his actual bodily fluids in with his paint on a canvas and then fucked off and sold it. Is there anybody, and again, you don't have to name names, but is there art where it's just like this, it doesn't feel like it's been reduced.
My personal feeling is that the world of comics is too inclusive.
Okay.
It's just exploded. There's a zillion graphic novels now, and I think 98% of it is garbage. Mm-hmm. It's not for me. I don't know, someone else, but it's not for me. But also, some of it's just straight up bad. Some people just don't know how to draw, and they don't seem to want to put the time into learning how to draw. It's lazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, I'm a person who I came into knowing that adults still were interested in comics later. I have always drawn. I'm not by no means like a professional level artist, but I have pulled up when someone will bring me into a comic shop and I'm like, oh, what's this? And I'll pull up a graphic novel and it looks so slapdash. And I'm like, well, maybe this is the style they're going for, but it does feel, because it's, paper mill stuff. It's just like, oh no, they banged it together. They banged it out as quick as they possibly could. And it just doesn't feel, the heart isn't there. Maybe, I don't know. Could be wrong. That's how it feels to me.
I don't know. I mean, I think that's always the way it is. Like back in the 80s, I rode that wave of humor books. That was a big thing in the 80s, starting with, 101 Uses for a Dead Cat and books like that. And it was really easy to get book deals. Mm-hmm. Like publishers, you just write up a 2-page outline and proposal and bang, you got yourself a book deal. Mm-hmm. And some of the stuff I did was not the greatest, but there was a lot of other stuff out there long forgotten that's just garbage. So there's always going to be garbage.
Sure.
But we were getting paid for our garbage.
Exactly right. And maybe a living wage sometimes. I mean, that's nice. That's a positive. So I am going to bring us back to the record for a second, because I don't want to keep you here all day, but do you have a favorite track off of An Evening with Mike Nichols and Elaine May out of those four tracks?
Oh, I like the three, the English and French and American adultery couples. They were saying the accents, especially her accents, are so fantastic. And I just started studying French with this app, because I had it like 4 years of it in high school, and the French are, the more exaggerated you make your French accent when you're trying to speak French, the better the French like it.
Okay, I love it.
And her French accent is just delightful. Yeah. Also, the British accent, the British are great too. It's
whenever he does a mousy voice, I really like it. Yeah. And whenever she does like a open, breathy or passionate voice, I love it so much. It's they're a good dynamic.
A sexy voice.
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt about that. He knows what he is. He's a whiny, He's very nebbishy. That's mostly what he is. Or that, or he adapts it to the annoying disc jockey character, who I also find very funny.
Oh, that was so great too.
Just we call him Papa.
Bernie. You know, I've never dated Bernie, but
Holy shit. And for her, again, she's playing a dumb character, but in the smartest possible way. And it's just, ugh, it's so good. It is, to me, heartbreaking again that she's not a household name. Now, she may not want to be a household name, but a little recognition, I'm sure, would be nice. You know, people in the know who she is, and she's a name, but, you know, she went behind the scenes and, again, hasn't done an interview in 40 years. I would love to break that streak. My God, I don't even know what I'd ask her. I'd be incompetent interviewing her. Much as I've been today interviewing you, I want to make sure this is going to come out in a few weeks. So I'd like you to let people know where they can find you, find your work, if there's anything coming up.
Nothing coming up anytime soon. My graphic novels, Over Easy and A Customer Is Always Wrong, are available in fine bookstores everywhere, online. Amazon, Barnes and Nobles, wherever you do your online shopping. I would encourage people to patronize their local bookstores to order books instead of using Amazon.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I have a friend in Vallejo, California, who has a bookstore struggling to stay open, a small local bookstore called Alibi Books, and you can order books from them. Please do that. Awesome. Alibi Books.
That's wonderful. And I forgot to ask you the question I ask every week about the album. In a couple sentences, it doesn't have to be a couple, but why listen to this album? Let's say somebody doesn't know who Mike Nichols or Elaine May are. Specifically Elaine May. Why give
yourself a treat of listening to Mike Nichols and Elaine May in, you know, whatever way you can, because they're just so brilliant. And their stuff is just as relevant today as it was when it was recorded. It hasn't dated at all. I mean, maybe you don't understand what a telephone operator is, but it's still going to work for you. It's so fresh.
Yeah. I still, K as in knife, P as in pneumonia. Those are two of the funniest things I've ever heard in my life. So good. So good. Well, thank you so much for doing this episode. I really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun for me.
It's really fun. You asked great questions.
Oh, well, thank you. Good. I felt just totally incompetent realizing, oh God, I just like cartoons. I don't know that I have anything I could say about them. Good God, your story is so fascinating. And, your story so far, my good God, there's so much going on. There's so much more stuff I would love to talk to you about. And maybe we will at some point. I really love, by the way, that you still have I'm just so happy that you have your early hardbound stuff. Like, that makes me pleased to no end. As an amateur archivist, I love that you hold on to your stuff.
Of course.
Not everybody does.
I have a sense of worth.
Good. See, that's important. Some people just throw their shit away. And I'm like, why? Why would you do that? Hold on to your shit. It shows where you've come from, where you've been. It's important to me. You know, well, thank everybody for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years. Dress Entertainment.
Hey, it's my turn. Ah!